Dan, since the beginning of time, how many asteroids do you think hit the planet, us?
Oh, goodness. In the countless millions and millions.
That many?
Well, I mean, it depends on the size you're talking about, right? If you're talking about macroscopic, big, you know, telescopic asteroids, yeah, I mean,
good
size
ones.
Now, if you're talking about meteorites and dust grain things, it's in the countless, you know, trillions. It's just a phenomenal number.
Okay, and now it's trickle. You know, we're not getting a lot.
Yeah, we're in the tail-off process. In the early days, you know, shortly after the planets formed, there was still a lot of the debris from which they formed, you know, wandering around the inner solar system, and so the number of collisions were much higher in the past. Now we're living, you're exactly right, it's the trickle-off time, it's the tail end of the process, and it's much more rare.
So were these asteroids from planets that blew up or asteroids from planets that never formed?
It seems to be planets that never formed. We see remnant disks of debris like this in the inner solar system between Mars and Jupiter, where we know that the gravitational influence of Jupiter keeps that region stirred up to the point that those objects could never completely accrete into its own planet. In the outer solar system, beyond Neptune, we see a similar remnant disk, this time of more ice-rich planetesimals. They're just little icy versions of asteroids, if you will. There's still some rocky material in there, too, but there's a lot more ice available out there. It's colder. And Pluto is just the largest member of this remnant disk out there.
So the asteroid belt is a belt of a planet that should have been.
It's the fossils of formation, yes.
To the phones we go again. Let's pick it up by going to our first-time caller line. Welcome to Coast on the Air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Dan. Todd out in Indianapolis.
Sure, Ted.
Listen, Dan, I got a couple of questions for you. What I wondered was I've been kind of interested in the last few weeks, especially after watching the History Channel special about the Bible codes and listening to a fellow named Harold Gans, who was a chief cryptologist for the National Security Agency. He's also an Orthodox Jew. But this man set out to prove that they were wrong, the codes were wrong, and in the end he wound up convincing himself just emphatically that these codes were actually authentic. But in these codes, one of the things that they predict is that an asteroid is going to collide with the Earth in the year 2012. And I was wondering if they had gotten any of that information to you, as I know that they have sometimes relayed some information that would seem to predict dangerous futures events mm-hmm. to governments. And also, what impact is the failure of the Hubble telescope going to have on any of your research, if any?
Oh, interesting. Good. In terms of any specific predictions for 2012, I'm not aware of anybody in our community that's been presented with any information like that. I do know that none of the asteroids that we've found so far. I think we've discussed almost over the last hour the one particular case of 2004 MN4, and that's the only one that for the foreseeable next couple decades is causing us any concern. None of the other asteroids that we've found, I know, are on any list of potential impact, and most specifically not for 2012. So I'm not aware of anything that's been coming our way in that regard. In terms of Hubble, it's the crippling of Hubble is an impact on the entire astronomical community, less so on the asteroid deflection or asteroid detection community. It turns out that Hubble is not very optimized for doing asteroid discovery work. It's a great object for actually studying asteroids that we do know about. In fact, I'm a co-investigator on a project to use Hubble to look not only to discover but to study moons of asteroids in the main asteroid belt out there. But in terms of searching for new asteroids, Hubble is not very well optimized because it's a very narrow field of view. For searching for asteroids, you like to look at over a big patch of the sky as you can to see as many objects as you can. But boy, it sure would be nice to keep Hubble working and doing all the great work it's been doing. We've we've learned a great deal from that great observatory.
Let's go to our wild card line. It's your turn on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hey, man. My name's Tim. I'm calling from Richmond, Virginia.
Hi, Tim.
Hey, I was calling in on something to do with, like, the chemtrails, the weather modification.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, because here lately I've heard a lot about solar flares going on and danger maybe of radiation.
Right.
I was wondering if weather modification and making the skies more cloudy could have anything to do with trying to shield some of the radiation from coming down and affecting agriculture and all of us mammals and everything.
Well, most of the shielding effects that the atmosphere does for us in terms of radiation from not only from the sun, from solar flare events, but from galactic cosmic rays that are the bits of particles shot out at high speeds, the atomic particles shot out at high speeds from supernova explosions. The actual protective benefits of the atmosphere for that radiation occur even much higher up in the atmosphere than the lower troposphere where weather and clouds actually occur. So any attempt to do something in the lower atmosphere to help with that wouldn't really be effective. All that action's already happening up there much farther up.
All right.
In fact, that's, you know, the ozone layer is created by the dissociation, the breaking apart of normal oxygen molecules in the atmosphere up at high altitudes, like 60, 80 kilometers up, just from the ultraviolet light from the sun, breaking apart O2, two oxygen atoms stuck together to make an oxygen molecule. The ultraviolet light is so energetic it blasts the bonds apart that bond the oxygen molecules together, and those little free individual oxygen atoms sometimes then react with other oxygen molecules to make temporarily O3, which is the ozone layer that then itself is actually rather absorbing of UV and helps protect us. And that, again, that's way up in the upper atmosphere.
Hey, the Mars rovers are still plodding along.
Oh, gosh, just absolutely fantastic missions, those. I was just at a meeting last week in Houston where Steve Squires, the mission principal investigator, started his talk with the very matter-of-fact statement that, well, we're now in day 420-something of our 90-day mission, and I just started clapping, everybody else started applauding, because it was just a wonderful statement of how successful those rovers have been. Spirit has actually been given a new lease on life. This is the one that has that landed near these hills, which we have now climbed nearly to the top of. But Spirit has been, this is the one with the one bad front wheel. It's been limping along up the mountains with this bad leg, conserving, being very careful all the way to always keep its solar panels oriented toward the sun, because they were getting very dusty.
Well, not anymore.
Not anymore. They one day, just as we are almost in the same day that we started to detect dust devils in some of the pictures, these are common to people who live out west in the dry desert out west, see dust devils all the time. Back east, they're a little bit more rare.
Little windstorms, huh?
We see these little things out there on Mars that we took pictures of them, and then just the very day that we were getting pictures of these, all of a sudden, the power being generated by the solar panels on Spirit jumped by 50%. It blew the dust off, which has actually gave it a whole new lease on life, because we were getting very darn near the sort of death level where the spacecraft or the rover really wouldn't be able to continue doing much, and it brought it back to almost new again. So
that's incredible.
It's the Energizer Bunny.
I mean, and that may happen again and again and again.
We are now entering the dust devil, the dust devil and dust storm season on Mars. So you got storms that can deposit dust, but the good news is those very same winds can also help clear the dust off as well.
And they're well over a year old now, aren't
they? Yeah, it's just we're into it's getting close to 430 Mars days.
And they're still going strong.
And still going pretty well. They're starting to show their age a little bit.
Yeah.
As I said, Spirit has got this little bit of arthritis in one wheel. Opportunity is going blind in one of its eyes because this is the thermal infrared instrument. It's getting cold, you know, and it's been through a number of cold cycles, and it's killing the instrument.
How far away are they from where they landed?
They have now driven about 3 and 4 miles.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's just amazing. They were meant to go. The design mission was going to be considered absolute success if they lasted 90 days and drove a couple hundred meters from their landing site. They've now gone miles, and we're now into over a year of operation. It's just a phenomenal success, and my hat is off to everybody on that team who's done such a great job.
Okay, next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Dan.
Hi.
This is Jose from West Covina.
Hi, Jose.
Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, Dan, can the planet Earth, with some type of phenomena, absorb inward all the water mass that we have, all the lakes, all the oceans inside the planet?
Sure, to some extent that actually goes on continuously, not to necessarily absorb all the water and to make it disappear, but all of the water in the Earth's oceans is continually cycled through the crust of the Earth in the process of plate tectonics. These deep ocean smokers that you may have seen pictures of from the deep submarines that are photographing these little oases of life in the deep oceans, the discovery of those smokers solved a big mystery that had been plaguing oceanographers for a number of years, and that's to explain the saltiness of the Earth's oceans. The conventional explanations up until that time had been that it's just the runoff of material from the continents, you know, running into the oceans by rivers, bringing in these salts dissolved off the surface of the Earth. But that wasn't a very good explanation. Now, by studying the flow going through these smokers on the deep ocean vents, and you know, accounting for all of the crustal fractures along the deep ocean ridges, adding up the total volume of water being cycled through those vents, going down a kilometer, into the Earth's crust, and then cycling back out as superheated water, dissolving some of the salts and minerals in the rock to therefore supply the salt in the ocean. It turns out that it looks like all of the volume of the Earth's water, Earth's oceans, are cycled through those vents every, of order 10,000 years or so.
But could it be, okay, I'm trying to think of...
I don't think you could actually have it actually completely absorbed in so that the oceans went dry, however. I'm not sure it's that kind of a volume in one sort of event that would be possible to do that.
Because there was two issues. One is Sean David Morton's February newsletter that brought out about the tsunami in the Indian Ocean.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, yes.
And also earlier this evening, George brought out the aspect that there's no water in other planets that we, our neighbors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that it was, like you brought out, there was water in Mars at one time,
right.
Abundant. So my theory, my question for that is because when, Sean David Morton brings out that there's epic centers that basically there's aftershocks from like 5.2 to 6.2, approximately every 78 hours there's a gap. There's another earthquake that's happening. It's like it's got straight lines going northward. And basically, Mr. Norton also brought up that it seems like someone is building a tunnel many miles below the Earth's surface. That was my question. I mean, it was weird and far out because basically, like George had John Lash a couple nights ago,
mm-hmm.
and he spoke of the pagans basically had the ability of remote viewing, psychics, and all this paranormal techniques. That basically they brought out the aspect of the inorganic, as we call it, extraterrestrial aliens. If that is the source, my opinion is that basically all these other planets that are neighbors, at one time had water,
mm-hmm.
and.
There is some evidence. I mean, there's significant evidence that almost an entire ocean's worth of water was probably cycled through the atmosphere of Venus. In other words, Venus may well have been much more Earth-like in its past, almost to the point of having Earth-like oceans, which it then lost. Part of that explanation is almost certainly due to the fact that Venus is closer to the sun. it has entered this sort of a runaway greenhouse effect where the atmosphere has been so heated by the contribution of carbon dioxide in its atmosphere that you just can't have water on the surface anymore. Any water in the atmosphere, any water on the surface would be driven into the atmosphere, of course, immediately by evaporation. And then once in the atmosphere, and this happens on the Earth too, the Earth does lose water over time just by the breakdown of the water molecules in the atmosphere, again, by the ultraviolet light from the sun. It splits the water into hydrogen and oxygen. The oxygen atoms are heavier, and they tend to stick around. The hydrogen atoms are so light that they tend to float off and disappear off the top of the atmosphere. And so that's a net loss mechanism for water, even on the Earth. On Venus, that process was driven to the extreme because of the runaway greenhouse effect.
What would water look like, Dan, in space? Does it stay together, or would it fall apart?
A liquid drop of water out there in space would probably, if it was near, you know, like room temperature when you let it out there, if you just dumped it out into space, you'd probably see it frizz and froth and evaporate away, almost like like the liquid equivalent of watching a little piece of dry ice skittle across a tabletop or something
until it was
gone. Slimes away.
What if you had an ocean out there in the universe? What would it look like?
Well, again, unprotected by a surface atmosphere, the motion of the water molecules themselves drives a pressure that causes it to rapidly evaporate. And so, in a pure vacuum, just liquid water by itself would pretty violently boil and froth and evaporate away into just essentially a cloud of water vapor now, which then you wouldn't see. It'd just be water molecules floating in a little patch in space, which themselves would be invisible.
Did I see a picture somewhere that was taken in space, though, that showed, water in the universe? I mean,
water is, other than hydrogen molecules, two hydrogen atoms stuck together, the water molecule is the most common molecule out there in space. It can float around individually as individual water molecules floating around in interstellar or intergalactic space. More often than not, water molecules floating around out there will run into some little dust particle, say, which is often very cold because out in the depths between the stars, it's pretty bitter out there. As soon as you are an individual water molecule and you run into something very cold, you tend to stick onto its surface. It's cold. It's a cold trap. That water molecule just runs on and sticks. Other water molecules may encounter it later on and also stick. And so what you end up with is, other than water molecules floating free in space, you tend to have ice-coated dust grains floating around in interplanetary and interstellar space as well.
Hey, Dan, stay in touch, and let's hope that the next time you're on, you're not telling us live that there's an asteroid coming our way. Huh?
I hope not. That's not something I want to have happen.
But if it does happen, you will do that.
We will be the people you'll talk to.
Thanks, Dan.
Great to talk to you.
Dan Derda, planetary scientist, four-year anniversary with me being here on Coast to Coast, April of 2001. He was my very first guest.